If I can take just a minute, often when someone's sick and out for a while, they have a card read. And in place of that, I'll just say how much I appreciate the concern over the last few weeks as a result of my injury. Without too much ridicule for doing foolish things and getting hurt, I found the cards and the food and the prayers and expressions of concern just very helpful. And I hope that that is offered, I believe it is, extended to everyone who suffers in some way or another, whether it's through their own foolishness or not. And I think this congregation is to be commended for that, and I offer that my thanks at this time. What began as a very frightening thing just became very painful. Now it's just very annoying. And so I guess I'm on the road to recovery. I want to remember, too, our youth meeting that's coming up on the 23rd. It's just 3 weeks away. We're hoping for everyone from middle school all the way up to college age to participate. We have some of our own members who will be presenting at that meeting, as well as some preachers and others, Christians from the area, who will be speaking to us about very important topics that have to do with decision-making with a Christian view. And I think it's a very relevant topic, and we hope you can set aside some time on your calendar for that. The Friday night before, we'll have some time to sing and have a devotional period, and then we'll start Saturday morning and go through middle of the afternoon with a short break for lunch. I'm going to speak tonight. Normally, David would be speaking on the first Sunday night, and he's away in a meeting, and I'm happy to do that, to fill in for him. And I wanted to do the lesson that I had planned to do the week before the meeting, which was when I wasn't able to be here on that Sunday. And so if you'll think of this context in the meeting context, this sermon in the context of being preached, maybe the lesson before the meeting was to begin, it might make more sense, but I think it fits with, given the many things we're attempting to do in the short term, the youth meeting, the lessons this summer, the visitation programs, and other things we're attempting to do. The Old Testament is full of examples of people that lived in exciting times. I think we get fired up about these exciting movies that are about war or about some exciting adventure against the elements, when really the Old Testament is full of God's revelation of those kinds of stories, sometimes carried out by godly people, sometimes by not so godly people. But as Jim mentioned this morning, the sacred writings are there to make us wise to salvation, and they were written for our learning. So we understand that looking at the Old Testament, we can understand more about salvation and can learn about things that would help us. Deborah and Barak is a story that the children have studied and the Old Testament tract has studied in recent weeks from the book of Judges, chapter 4 and 5. And so they are probably experts, and they'll find some details maybe that I'm mixed up on and can straighten me out afterwards. But you all should know the story of Deborah and Barak. And we'll talk about that tonight. Deborah and Barak. Barak is mentioned in the book of Hebrews, and David mentioned these passages in talking about Samson in the invitation the other night. What more shall I say, for the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak, Samson, Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the alien. I even think maybe David picked the song for this reason. This faith is the victory. There are a couple of phrases in there that may relate to the battle that Barak fought. In the second verse, the third line, by faith they like a whirlwind's breath swept on o'er every field. And then in the third verse, the third line, the earth shall tremble neath our tread and echo with our shout. The culmination of the story is, of course, Barak's charge down into the valley, and we'll get to that. But an exciting story. And it's a literal battle, and I think we need to think about challenges in our life, which may be just as frightening, just as challenging, but perhaps on a spiritual nature, because our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual enemies. This story takes place during the time of the Judges. And the Judges was a time when Israel as a nation was failing. They were failing God's test. They had failed to adequately drive out the nations that had occupied the land, though God told them to do it. He told them they could do it if they would. But worse than that, they broke His commandments with regard to making covenants with those nations, with regard to intermarrying with those nations. Not that intermarrying between races is necessarily wrong, but he said if you do that, you'll go after their gods. You will serve their idols, and that's exactly what has happened. And so over and over in the period of the judges, and I know the children have studied this. In fact, we overheard through the wall from our class this morning, one of the classes repeating this cycle, remembering how the Israelites would sin, and God would send to punishment, and after the punishment they would cry out, and he would send a deliverer. And they would be saved and have a short period of rest, and then the cycle would begin again. And that was the period of time. If you want to look in Judges 2:2-3 and 3:6, you'll see the angel of God comes to Israel and comes from Gilgal, which is a place where the shame was rolled away. Circumcision was renewed. The Passover was kept, as recorded in the book of Joshua. That angel apparently travels now to a place that becomes known as a place of weeping and says, "You failed. You have not obeyed the commands," in chapter 3. And he says, "I'm going to leave the nations there as a snare. They'll be a thorn to you, and they will test you. They will test your righteousness." And when they did sin, those nations then would punish them by putting them in bondage or running them up into the hills, cutting off their commerce, stealing their property, and so on. However, when you look at Judges, I think it's helpful to try to picture what the ideal would have been. What did God expect the nation of Israel to be like? There was no earthly king. There didn't even seem to be a real organized government. They were really just separate tribes spread out among that land. The Levites, I suppose, formed some type of a glue, at least for the teaching of the law between all the people. But what was to be their civil authority? How were they to protect themselves as a nation against a larger, mightier power from outside? How were they to have an identity and a culture as a people that would be somewhat unified? What was the ideal? I think we can see the ideal nation would be one in which Jehovah was their king. Later, when they ask for a king, Samuel is told, By God, you're not the one rejected. I've been rejected, that I should not be king over them. Jehovah would be their king, and they would live in their awareness of his presence. Jephthah's a striking man. It says he spake all his words before Jehovah. What if every citizen in that nation of Israel thought about everything he said and everything he did in light of the fact that the king was watching? Jehovah was there, watching over every action that they carried out. Secondly, the law of Moses was to be their guide. And really, the law covered both religious and civil laws. And so they knew how to live. And if there were crimes, they knew how to punish those things. And the Levites were there to carry out those commands. And so there would have been, if the law of Moses had been respected, a way to make sure justice was performed, and a way to enforce the law even for those that would be, on occasion, disobedient. But what about protection? Jehovah was to be their military strength. And that seems strange, because they sat among nations whose technology was higher than theirs. The Philistines, for example, apparently had conquered the art of metallurgy at that time. And we'll see the Canaanites had chariots of iron. Clearly, the Israelites were way behind on that. And even as late as the time of Samuel, the Israelites had to travel down to the Philistines just to get their farm implements sharpened, because they did not have that technology themselves. So how would they protect themselves against the nations around them? What kind of an army would they have? Would they have people in constant training? Would they have a draft system? How was that to happen? Well, I think we can look back in the history and see the kinds of military victories that had led up to the time of Judges, in trying to paint the picture of what the nation of Israel could have been, but was not. Starting with the Egyptians at the Red Sea, Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you this day. The Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." The Amalekites at Rephidim, that's the place where, remember, Moses had to hold his arms up to keep the battle going. And when he let them down, clearly God was in charge, and God was making that happen, just because Moses' arms didn't have anything to do with the army fighting. That was God's way of showing he was actually carrying out the battle. And the Amorites, Sihon and Og, and here's a quote. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Do not fear him. I have delivered him into your hand with all his people and his land.'" Later, Midian in Numbers chapter 31 was led by Phinehas as God commanded, as a kind of a retribution for the things that Midian had done to Israel. Of course, we know about Jericho in Joshua 6, clearly God's hand in bringing the walls down at that point. And later at Ai, on the second try. You remember Ai, the first try, God was not with them because of what they had done in Jericho. One person had taken some treasures from that city. But when God was with them, they conquered the city of Ai. And then the five Amorite kings in Joshua chapter 10. In that particular instance, there were hailstones that came down and killed many. Was that a miracle? Or was that God's provision? And that's also the occasion in which the sun stood still. Here's what God said to Joshua. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them. I have delivered them into your hand." What's interesting about that is this language that's past tense. The battle hasn't happened yet, and yet God says it's already happened. It's as good as done. I have delivered them into your hand. And finally, the Canaanite alliance, if you want to call it that, in Joshua chapter 11. The quote there is, "The Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid because of them. Tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel.'" See, do you see how the defense of the nation was supposed to happen? When the enemy came up, God would say, "I've delivered them into your hand." And the people would just go out to battle as God had commanded them, expecting the victory to be won by hailstones, by the sun standing still, by the walls falling down, by some means, and often they didn't know. But they were just supposed to carry out those commands and go forward. Really, going backward in time to the time of Moses, God said, "As long as you keep my commandments, this kind of superiority over your enemies would be in place. For if you carefully keep all these commandments which I command you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations before you. You will dispossess greater and mightier nations than yourselves." And down in verse 25, "No man shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon all the land where you tread, just as he has said to you." And Jim talked about those promises. They were conditional on the people keeping God's commandments, and yet they really had nothing to fear. It wasn't a matter of having enough people or having the technology or the arms or the training or the high ground or whatever was required for military victory. They just needed to trust in God. And when it was time to face the enemy, on God's command, they would go and take the enemy. And that's what was intended. And that brings us to the story of Deborah. I just would say that a few times in the book of Judges, you can see glimpses of this potential strength. What I'm trying to paint is a picture of what the nation of Israel could have been, with every man doing what was right in God's eyes, not what was right in his own eyes. The nation brought together by their faith in God, their obedience to his law, and then depending on God for their strength. When you look at the book of Judges, you see Othniel. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he went out, and the Lord delivered Cushan Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. Ehud, once he had killed Eglon, said, "Follow me, for the Lord has delivered." There's that past tense, in advance of the event occurring. Kind of a flash of the way things ought to be, ought to have been all the time. And Gideon, interesting language again. Past tense, talking about the future. "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." That was his cry as they went forward down into the battle. So you see a little bit of a glimpse of how the nation could have been, trusting in God and just going into battle confident of what might have happened. If you want to turn to Judges chapters 4 and 5, that'd be on page 169 in the Pew Bibles. We want to pick up the story of Deborah and Barak at that point. The setting of the story is this. It was probably a century or more after the end of Joshua's generation, that is, Joshua and those who were with him. And in between had been those amazing characters, Ehud and Shamgar, which could have been in their memory, as well as the things that Joshua had done before. During that time, Israel had fallen into idolatry, and the result was God had given them a 20-year period in which the Canaanites had dominated them. The king was named Jabin, and he reigned in Hazor, which was up in the north, north of the Sea of Galilee. But the captain of his army, Sisera, controlled the level ground that runs down from Mount Carmel down to the east, kind of the southeast. We'll see a map in just a minute. With 900 chariots of iron. 900 chariots of iron. By contrast, if you look over in chapter 5, verse 8, during the Song of Deborah, Deborah points out that before this happened, not a shield nor spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not, but that's not many weapons. So Israel did not have many weapons, nor the technology that was there, nor horses, nor chariots. We also learned from the song that village life had ceased, and that travel along the roads had pretty much been restricted to sneaking around by the byways. So life was miserable. You couldn't live in the towns because you were subject to attack by the Canaanites. You couldn't travel along the roads because that's the place where, of course, they would be dominant. So you had to sneak around by the back roads. And you can imagine what that did for the economy, for the social environment, and so on. It appears there was little national unity. And we'll see that Deborah praises the rise of leadership, but it took someone to go and recruit from among the tribes just to get an army together. So it appears there was very little leadership in Israel, in addition to the immorality that probably came with idolatry. But Deborah and apparently others were faithful who would come up to listen to Deborah, who was inspired, a prophetess. And they would come up and have judgments from her given to them. And you know, that's kind of interesting too, because once you get through the book of Judges, which is for the most part not a pleasant book with regard to the general morality, even of some of the heroes. Think of Samson, for example, David talked about Wednesday night. At that same time, there was another little story going on called the Book of Ruth. And what a wonderful story and a wonderful contrast to what you see in the book of Judges. And here, too, I think, is a glimpse of Deborah, in some ways privately maybe, issuing judgment, speaking for the Lord, and people coming up to see her. So that even in this kind of dark situation, dark militarily and dark spiritually, still there were those faithful, including Deborah at that time. Here is the location of the events, and maybe I can use this map to show a few things here. This is the river Kishon, and it represents that valley I was talking about right here in this area. Hazor is where Jabin is ruling as the Canaanite king, and it appears that Sisera had set up his army, his chariots, down in this area, south of this valley that runs through here. A key place in this story is going to be Mount Tabor. And it's across the valley, over here on the northwest side, about halfway between the Sea of Galilee and these towns down here, Megiddo and Taanach. And Taanach seems to be the place that the battle took place, somewhere in between here and there, because it's mentioned in the poems, but you can get the idea. Barak himself is from Naphtali, and Deborah is down in Ephraim where she's prophesying. So you can get an idea roughly where all these things were that were taking place. Well, here's a topographical map to kind of illustrate the scenery here. First of all, this is Mount Tabor. This is where the armies of Sisera seem to have gathered. And this valley in here is where the battle ended up taking place. What's interesting about that is, of course, Jabin and the Canaanites occupied the valleys for tactical reasons. That's where chariots work best. They don't do too well on steep hills and on mountains, sharp mountains. And that's why the Israelites pretty much stayed in the higher areas, the hill country. The other thing that happens is, as Deborah calls Barak, she kind of says, hasn't God called you to lead here? In chapter 4, let's just read the way that her language is stated there. She sent, called for Barak, verse 6, the son of Abinoam from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord of God Israel, Lord God of Israel, commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. And then verse 7 appears to be saying what God has said as well, and against you, I, that is God, will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. Think about that. He is supposed to go through this northern area and gather an army, and he seems to be able to gather about 10,000 men, and they meet up on Mount Tabor. We'll look at Mount Tabor in just a minute. But there's no way you could gather at that mountain in secret, I don't think, with 10,000 people. And it's clear he didn't try to keep it a secret, and it's clear that Sisera knew they were there, because as soon as he found out, if you look on down in chapter 4, verse 12, they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So there's no secret here. Barak has gathered a lot of people up on top of this fairly steep mountain, and Sisera knows he's there. So you think about the tactical situation here. They're in a safe place up on the mountain. Sisera is waiting down in the valley with his chariots. Barak seemed to show some doubt. I guess that's the reason he asked Deborah to go with him. Most people think that. What did he expect her to do for him? I don't know exactly. One thing could be that as he went to recruit the army, it may be that her credibility was important for them to follow him. That could be. It also may be that he wanted additional guidance, because it appears that there was the time when it was time to go charge, she hadn't said, okay, time to go, and maybe get him to go on down and make the charge. So, but he wanted her support. The result was, of course, she said that the glory for the battle would go to a woman. Maybe he thought that would be her. It turned out it wasn't, but that's what she said. Her intent was not to lead the armies, but rather to go ahead and encourage, exhort Barak into doing what he apparently should have known to do, just based on this language. Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying? Once again, maybe it's a past tense looking to the future. Same thing with Gideon. He's called a mighty man of valor long before he maybe proves that he is, but God expects him to be that, and that's the nature of the language that's used. This is Mount Tabor. It's a pretty steep and kind of isolated hill, if you kind of look at it. This must be an aerial view. I don't know where else it would have been taken. If you go to the west and up on the Nazareth Ridge and look across, you can see that same mountain, Mount Tabor, over there. What's interesting in this picture, I don't think those people were there at the time of Barak, but what's interesting is the flat land down below. Do you see how flat it is down? Once they come off the mountain, they're just in a plain, and it's pretty flat. The mountain is steep, and there's that plain that's there. Here's another view looking across that plain up to the mountain. Now, I don't know the contours exactly the same today as they were then. They probably aren't. But do you see the tactical advantage that Sisera would have with his chariots down in the flat area and what would be given up as you charged down out of the mountain? And so I just imagine on top of that mountain, this is a view from the top looking out across that plain. Imagine Deborah and Barak standing there looking down, and the 900 chariots and maybe more soldiers are down in the valley. And Deborah says, it's time to go. Now, what is Barak thinking? Well, here's some things he might be thinking about. Here I am with an untrained army with few weapons. Here I am against an enemy that has a technological advantage. I have no element of surprise. Gideon had that. Remember that story? Middle of the night, apparently timed even in the watch of the night where people would be mostly asleep. But that's not the case here. There's no surprise. I'm going to leave the stronghold position up here on the mountain, and I'm going to take the battle down into the place where the enemy has the advantage. What was he thinking about? And Deborah says to go. What were his chances? What were his chances? Well, how did the battle turn out? It's interesting that the message of how the Bible turned out is fairly simple. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. That just seems inconceivable. How could that happen? But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. How did that happen? How could that happen against that enormous army? Was there a miracle? Was there something like that? Well, we really get more information from the song of celebration that Deborah sings and that's recorded in chapter 5. And I'll look at a few verses that I think give us a pretty good explanation for how this happened. And so the rest of the story of the battle is found in these selected verses out of Judges chapter 5. In verse 4, Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, these are places down in the south, and it appears that perhaps a storm was brewing and coming up out of the south. The earth trembled and the heavens poured. You ever been in a thunderstorm where it seemed like the earth was just shaking? We had some thunder the other night. Earth is just shaking and the water's pouring down. And think about how animals, horses, would do in a situation like that with a frightening thunderstorm and a lot of pouring rain. The mountains gushed before the Lord. Can you imagine the rain so heavy that the water's just rushing down the hills? this Sinai. And you know what the reference there is to that mountain that was smoking and shaking at Sinai? And he's saying that's the way the weather was on the day of that battle before the Lord God of Israel. And then down in verse 19 of chapter 5, the kings came and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. That means they didn't win. They fought from the heavens, the stars, from their courses fought against Sisera. And here I think is a reference to perhaps the fact that the heavens were contributing to this. The sky was coming down in favor of Barak and his army. The torrent of Kishon swept them away, that ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. I happened to be able to go to Israel on business a couple of years ago. And the road up the coast is really heavily traveled and real a lot of traffic certain times of day. So the guy that took us kind of went around, you know, that Mount Carmel Valley and kind of came right up that valley just as a shortcut because we were trying to get to, what's the city there on right on the Mount Carmel? I can't remember the big city. It's a little bit like San Francisco. Somebody can help me out. Haifa, thank you, that's it. We're going to go to Haifa. And we came right up the valley. And I said, now the river Kishon's around here somewhere, isn't it? He said, the river? And he said, it's just a little dry stream almost. And what's interesting, though, on this day and at this time, it was a flood. And it flooded its banks and apparently bogged down the ground so that the horses and chariots couldn't move. He calls it that ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. Oh, my soul, march on in strength. The horse's hoofs pounded the galloping of his steeds. And I don't know if that's the galloping of God's horses in the thunder and the storm, or if it's this idea of horses being frightened and trampling all around and keeping on in their panic, you know. But do you get a picture of the battle now? As Barak charges down that hill, a great storm, lightning and thunder, water gushing down from the hills, the river flooding, the mud and the horses being frightened and stuck in the mud. And that explains perhaps why Sisera jumped out of his chariot and ran away. Why would he do that if he was trying to get away? I'd have stayed in there if it were possible to get it to move. But apparently they were bogged down or else the horses weren't able to be controlled. So they won the battle. How does this relate to us? Do you ever feel like you're standing on top of Mount Tabor looking down at a superior army with some challenge that we have to meet in some way? Here are some of our challenges, something that I think about a lot, the elders do, and others I know. One is to get every member to heaven. What a challenge. All of us, wherever we are, with whatever we know, with the problems we wrestle with, the things that drag on us from the world and the outside and our past, what a challenge. How can we counteract the world's influence on all of us that starts the minute we get up and almost doesn't stop till we finally go to bed at night? In the people, in the media, the things we see as we drive. What a challenge to try to eliminate that and to counteract it. How can every member be helped to grow into the stature of Christ? Wherever they are in what they know, in their faith, in their strength, whatever personal problems, how can we do that? How can we rear our children to be Christians? There's a long-term project and a frightening one, a scary one. What a challenge there is sometimes for that. Those are a few of our challenges. And how about convert the city of Atlanta? Does that seem like a daunting task? God's asked us kind of, okay, go. Let's do it. And finally, how about take the gospel into all the world? These are things, aren't we asked to start? Give it a try? Make a charge? What a challenge they are. I think in the story of Deborah and Barak, we can see some keys to victory, at least what God expects us to do. Remember that this care that God would give to Israel, that Jehovah would offer Israel in victory, was contingent on their doing what he said, following their commandments. And in this example of Barak and Deborah, I think we can see some things that will help us to face these challenges and succeed. Here are some lessons and applications. What were the keys to success that you can see in this story? In chapter 5, in the Song of Deborah, in verse 2, I think there are two in that one verse alone. The first thing I would point out is that leaders lead. The New King James reads, "When leaders lead in Israel." That's an interesting phrase, apparently, and not too easy to translate out of the Hebrew. The definition actually means to begin, to let loose, to show strength. And if you have the New Revised Standard Version, it has a really interesting translation, which is when locks are long in Israel. That's locks of hair. Locks of hair. And what does that have to do with leaders leading? Well, you know that long hair is associated with strength. Certainly the case of Samson, maybe Absalom, another example of someone with long hair and proud of that. But the idea is that there's a source of strength and it's let loose. It's let loose. It's brought to bear. The strength is shown. It stands up and it's there to do its work. When locks are long, when leaders lead. And you know, I think there are cases where there are leadership roles that need to be taken. There are elders who are charged with taking care of the church of God that are mentioned. If some of the men here are not ready, why not? What needs to be done? How can we qualify ourselves? If someone isn't selected, what can be done anyway to show strength, to go forward, to lead, to pick up the work that needs to be done? Teachers, deacons and teachers. Teachers have a leadership role. And there's a need for teachers. It seems like we're always short of teachers for the children's classes who lead the way in teaching God's Word and meeting the challenges we talked about before. Husbands and fathers, what a challenge there to take the spiritual leadership in the family, to try to counteract the worldly influence, to set goals and make decisions that would help the family grow in a spiritual way. It requires strategic thinking, watchfulness, the ability to understand God's Word and to implement the plans you've made, the knowledge, strength, and patience. Those are great challenges, leadership roles that are taken. And we have to think about Deborah as well. In chapter 5, verse 7, it says a mother arose in Israel. Until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. It doesn't say she was the mother of Israel, but she was a mother. We know she was married. It lists her husband's name in chapter 4. So maybe she was just a mom. Maybe she meant to say, here is a mother doing a wonderful thing. But it could be that there's also a reference to the fact that she was taking the role that a mother has to take to encourage her son of whatever age to do what he should be doing, what he knows has to be done. And I would have to say that in all of the relationships that women have, that is a key role, is to push us men into doing what we know we should be doing. Certainly that's what a wife has to do. I'm not talking about not being in subjection. I'm talking about pushing a person forward into what they know they should be doing. I know a lot's made about Deborah and her role, maybe as a justification for women taking some position of leadership in the church. I think that's a dangerous thing, to take a story where there's not very much really said about exactly what she did and carrying it a long way, even beyond passages that are quite literal about the restrictions on the role of women. But what we can make of the story is that she encouraged Barak to go do what he knew to do. And when it was time to go, she said, it's time to go, and had him do it. I would just, as if you'll forgive a personal reference here, during the time about 3 years ago when we were considering appointing me to be an elder, there were several members that talked to me, but I have to say more women than men did. And the things the women had to say in general were more direct. And by that I mean, Marty, you need to work on this. Here's something that's a weakness for you, and you need to think about that. I'm not talking about any kind of disrespect or anything. I'm saying things I needed to hear were said. And how many mothers are there that can look to their sons or their husband or even other men and say what needs to be said in a kind way? And even now, I get advice. Maisel, in particular, gives me advice all the time. And she is a mother in Israel, in that sense of the word. And that's the kind of guidance we need. And that is a form of leadership. It is encouraging people. It's a strength to be let loose to show what needs to be done. Mothers in Israel. And then I think any time that initiative is taken in anything that needs to be done, even when there's no formal recognition or formal title, And that's why this definition is interesting. I don't think it just means when the elected officials get busy and do what they're supposed to do. I think it means when any time there's an opportunity to take the initiative and someone does it. I think that's really what it's saying, whether it's Deborah or Barak or any of those who helped them. And I think as you look around, how many times have you heard someone say, you know, this parking lot is really getting trashy. Someone ought to do something about that. Or so-and-so has not been here in weeks. Someone ought to give them a call. You see the point. You see something needs to be done. We all have the ability to do it. We don't have to be elected to that office. It's a form of leadership. Strength being shown in a way that's useful in the kingdom. The second thing I think we can see in the very same verse is that the people willingly offered themselves. And the poem goes on to talk about those who did that. And I'll just give some examples. In verse 14, it appears that Ephraim, whose roots are in Amalek. Now there's a strange phrase, because Amalek was one of the enemies of Israel. But it appears that Ephraim had experience in war, perhaps in the battles against the Amalekites. And they brought that. They brought that to the battle. And so when the leaders set up a plan and they say it's time to go, it's wonderful when people can bring their experience and abilities to bear and can go forward under the leadership and the initiative of those who start the program and then carry it forward. It says in verse 14 that Machir, and that's probably Manasseh, that's a family within Manasseh, but Manasseh and Zebulun apparently led and recruited others. It says, from Ephraim, whose roots were in Amalek, after you, Benjamin, with your peoples from Machir, rulers came down, and from Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff. In verse 15, Issachar was willing to be sent. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah, as Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command. Now that word, under his command, literally means under his feet. And there is a place for those who will give up their right to criticize, their right to take judgment and say, okay, that's somebody's plan. I'm going to go with it. I'll just do it. And whatever they say, we'll do that. And that apparently was the attitude of Issachar. And finally, Zebulun is mentioned in verse 18 as a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death, Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. When you go and follow someone, take their judgment, their lead, and their initiative, there may be risks involved. There may be risks to your own success or your health or something that's valuable to you, but you take those risks and throw yourself in to the program, whatever it is that's being brought about. I would say in the local church in particular, we have plans that we set. The elders and the deacons in particular are really in charge of organizing things that we try to do. Things that Jim mentioned this morning, the visitation program, the cleaning the building, the singings that we have, the group meetings in particular, is a great work that we need to do. And it may be that that's not the way any of us else would have decided to do things, to get people visited, to get the grounds clean. And yet, a leader has taken the initiative to set a plan in place, and the people, when the people offer themselves willingly, they say, okay, I'll bring my abilities to bear, I'll take risks if I have to, but I'll be there willing to submit. If you think about many of the activities that we have, meetings, the singings that we have, the special classes, the upcoming vacation Bible school. Some people have taken the lead in organizing that, but there's much work to be done. Really just a matter of saying, what can I do? And whatever they say, go and do it. Offer ourselves willingly in what they need to have done. The visitation Jim mentioned at length this morning, I think, is a good example of something where we might find in our own thinking better ways to do it, but something we can support. And I even think in families, when fathers and husbands are trying to implement a plan, think about how much easier it is for them when the wife says, I'll willingly implement that. And you think about it in the chain that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 11:3, where Christ is head over the man over the woman. Jesus tells us what he wants done, but he leaves quite a bit to our judgment and our initiative to figure out how best to do it, how best to take the gospel to the world, for example, and how best to teach others and so on. And in the same way, when a husband or a father sets a plan in place, there's a great deal of creativity and initiative and courage that has to be shown by those who would take up that leadership and follow and offer themselves willingly. So in families, wives who eagerly implement the husband's planning, Children who quickly obey parents without question and negotiation. Those are examples of those who offer themselves willingly. But by contrast, in verses 15, 16, and 23, some of the other tribes were mentioned in not so good of a light. It says here that Reuben had great resolves and searching of heart. I wonder if that describes us sometimes when, well, there's a meeting going on and I'm really tired. Maybe we ought to go. You know, we didn't go last night. Maybe we should. You know what I'm talking about? Searching of heart. Maybe we ought to. Now, I think sometimes people who search their heart and don't do anything are the most miserable of all, because there's this weighing of conscience. You know, I really should, and I don't, and I'll be embarrassed, and I, you know, and you wrestle with that. And that's not helpful. Those who search their heart and have great resolve, but they didn't come. And maybe they said, y'all do a good job down there. Maybe we'll see you there. But really the intent wasn't there. It says Gilead, Dan, and Asher stayed home. It says they stayed beyond the Jordan. Why did Dan remain on ships? Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlets. I guess I would just say they were busy. They stayed home and they were busy with other things. I don't think they searched their hearts. They just had stuff to do. Not including defending Israel. And I think sometimes our lives are filled with the things we're doing. We're fishing, we have our ships, we're out by the lake, whatever we're doing. And the things that have been planned to try to accomplish the goals are just beyond our thinking, and that we're just not involved. And then there's this reference in verse 23 to Meroz. Nobody knows where Meroz is or was. All we know is that the angel of the Lord cursed that city, because apparently they did not come to the help of the Lord, to help the Lord against the mighty, verse 23. Now, that verse is in the context of the story about how Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, you remember, that's how Sisera finally was killed, she killed him. But that verse is just before that, and almost suggests, and many people think this is the explanation, that Meroz might have been a village near Mount Tabor. And as the armies were fleeing, they didn't do anything. They had the opportunity to participate, to help, and maybe they were even called to help, stop them. Maybe try to help us catch Sisera, like Jael did in the next verse. But they didn't. They refused. They seem to have refused to help. Some have even suggested they might have been in league with the Canaanites in some way. But what a discouragement, so that God's angel actually curses them. Maybe that explains why we don't know where they are or what happened to them. But what a discouragement to be asked directly for help and not just refuse. And those are the other side of those who, the contrast to those who willingly offer themselves. Despite that, of course, everyone benefited from the work of those who came with Barak and Deborah. Now, what's the third thing? It's found in verse 3. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I, even I, will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the God of Israel. I think the key in all of this is that God gets the glory. Victory here was clearly not due to man's might. And I think we need to see anything that we accomplish here, whether it's converting someone or having a good teaching program or being able to support many men all around the world, not as something we have accomplished, neither the leaders nor the followers, but something that God has done. And clearly in this battle, as with all those other battles we saw earlier, God's hand was in it, and He made it that way. He almost puts us at a disadvantage in our challenges, so that it's clear that it's His gospel or His power that's at work in what He does. And so the victory was clearly not due to man's might. Not only that, we often don't even know how it's going to turn out. When we go and spread the gospel or do some type of an effort to reach people, we don't really know how that will turn out. And we leave the outcome to God. And even sometimes what we see may not look successful in our eyes. God's plan is for the local church to do its best with its resources to support preachers wherever they go. And that's what we do. Some see that program, that plan, as inadequate. It's not enough money. The world's too big. There's too big of a challenge. Well, that's the way this battle was, in most of the battles of the Israelites. But He told us to do it, and so we just start and do it, in whatever way God determines the outcome. The result of that is there's no strife or jealousy about position or glory, because you don't get the glory. It's God that gets it. It's not the leader who came up with the plan. And on the other hand, if things don't look like they're turning out just right, there should be no grumbling about apparent failure. And you see the Israelites are a bad example here as well. Things didn't look like they were going well when Pharaoh was closing in on them at the Red Sea. And they began to grumble and complain. Or when they were without water, or when they were hungry in the wilderness. And yet, that's the time when God's power is shown at its height. Deborah says, near the end, I will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. The poem ends by saying, let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in its full strength. I think that should be our picture of all of our endeavors. Just imagine the end of the battle when Deborah and Barak were victorious and the armies of Sisera had been destroyed. As we face our challenges of encouraging one another, reaching the lost, guiding our families, rearing our children, we need to picture the end in which the sun comes out and all the darkness and doubt and the difficulties and the troubles are gone away. Jesus is our leader in a larger sense. He's a perfect leader. He's taken the initiative on our behalf, and he set up a plan by which we may be saved. And he's asking us to offer ourselves willingly to his leadership. We'd like to offer that chance to anyone tonight who needs to do that as we sing the invitation song. Come forward, confess your faith in him as the Son of God, and to be baptized to wash away your sins. If those instructions are unfamiliar to you, we would like to study with you about that and show you where in the Bible that kind of teaching might be found. But if you know what you need to do, this is an opportune time to do that, and we'd encourage you to do it as we stand and sing.